Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Tom Woods Show, episode 2392. So glad to have our old friend Alex Epstein back on the show. Doggone it, I was trying to find my copy of Fossil Future somewhere. I mean, like, I have all these nice looking books. They are not organized in any way.
I was looking for it on that shelf.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I got George Reisman's Huge Capitalism somewhere around there. I got great, great books. Could not find it because I just haven't organized them at all. I can assure you it's there because I have urged people. I know you have a million TV shows you could watch, you have a million books you could read, but one of the things that is central to our future as a species is available energy, inexpensive energy. And yet it's like there is some kind of sick conspiracy against it everywhere you turn. And the best defense you're going to find of civilization and why fossil fuels are so important to it is the book Fossil Future by Alex Epstein. He's also got a Substack, Energy Talking Points Substack. I'm going to link to it in the description or on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/2392. So there's always stuff to talk about with you. One interesting thing before we get into our specifics I want to ask you about today, I've noticed that a number of times Vivek Ramaswamy has mentioned you by name and has also adopted your human flourishing framework as a way of thinking about these energy issues. So, I mean, that has to be gratifying.
For sure. So in the last 3 years, you mentioned the Energy Talking Points Substack. I've had this project called Energy Talking Points, and the basic goal has been to give very convenient, compelling, comprehensive, what I call talking points on every issue imaginable. So, you know, I'm always sending you different Twitter threads that I put out and stuff. But the idea of those is to cover every issue you could possibly imagine, compelling points, in a format that's really usable, that's really convenient. And the original idea was that politicians could use it. I used to try to advise politicians by giving them high-level advice, but they have so much work to do. It's hard for them to take a class or apply it. So I just decided I'm just going to write the exact way of talking about every single issue imaginable. And so now we work with something like 200 major offices. A number of the presidential candidates have asked me for advice in various ways. Vivek, publicly, it's known that we know each other and we've interacted with each other. He's been on my podcast. So yeah, it is really cool to see him using that, you know, 98% decline in climate-related disaster deaths. And because he's read Fossil Future and I think really internalized it, it's really cool to see the back and forth with the mainstream outlets that would never touch me, or at least at this point won't touch me. So they're not going to interview me on CNBC or CNN, because what's the upside? There's a huge downside for them, right? I guarantee, if they have me on that show and try to debate me. But they have to interview presidential candidates. So that's been really cool to see.
I want to start by asking you kind of an oddball question, but it's really not an oddball question. Because as I'm sure you realize, there are a lot of school children in the U.S. who really are terrified about climate change. And you can understand why. They don't have the ability yet to distinguish propaganda from reality or think about what it means to make trade-offs or anything like this. They're just told that because we all live in a selfish way and we're not thinking about the future, that it's quite possible that terrible catastrophic events could occur. So suppose, now you think it's unlikely you'd be on some of these programs, it's less likely that you'd be invited to speak to an elementary school, but suppose you were.
Well, some I would be.
But probably not the random school down the road, I would say. So
yeah, probably.
But suppose you're there though, and you have the chance to say something at a level these kids could understand that will make them not feel so anxious about this. How would you explain it to them?
Interestingly, I think it's very similar to what adults need. Let me just say what's needed and then how to explain it. I think what's needed is to understand how inhospitable the Earth was before we figured out how to use machines to be productive and prosperous. Because the narrative people have now is everything good about life that we take for granted, living this in this abundant and safe world, that's natural. And so the fear has to be disrupting nature, what they'll often call the delicate balance. I sometimes call this the idea of the delicate nurture. And so your whole fear is about, let's not rock the boat, let's not change anything. And it has this then plausibility that, oh, well, the next impact that we have, whether it's consuming resources or emitting something in the air or impacting climate in some way, that's going to make the whole system crash down. Whereas if you realize, no, wait a second, the planet in its natural, unimpacted state is dynamic. It's not stable, so it's changing all the time. It's deficient. It doesn't give us enough resources. It gives us way too few resources for 8 billion people or even 1 billion people. And then it is very dangerous. It is not a safe place. And so what human beings have done is we've mastered it to a point where we're far safer from climate than ever. So I want to basically tell them, if they were interested in climate, as I'd say, yeah, actually the world used to be in a perpetual climate emergency. Like before modern times, people were terrified because they couldn't get enough rain when they needed it. They didn't know how to deal with it when it was hot. They didn't know how to deal with it when it was cold. That's why they prayed to these different kinds of gods, and they were afraid, and they were just trying to do something about this, and they couldn't do anything. And it was a real climate crisis. It really preoccupied their lives. But what we've done is we figured out how to use machines to be so capable that we can do things like make it cool when it's hot, or make it warm when it's cold, or irrigate areas where there's not a lot of rainfall so that millions of people don't die. So the story of climate is actually we're in an unprecedented state of climate mastery where almost anything imaginable that could happen to the global climate system, we are demonstrably capable of dealing with. In the United States, we deal with every climate imaginable, right? We have polar Alaska, swampy Florida, Texas. You know, I happen to live in a nice place, Laguna Beach. But even that was trouble before we had the capabilities that we do. So I would just teach them the story of climate mastery and really show them that the emergency was in the past and the emergency is living, trying to live with nature.
I think that's a great way to put it. Now, the Biden administration, this is you're telling people about how you send me threads you have on Twitter. Biden administration is apparently being urged to declare a, quote, climate emergency. I think that's what it is, a climate emergency.
That's what it's called, yeah.
So suppose Biden does say, I officially declare a climate emergency. What's the practical result of that? I mean, obviously, constitutionally, here I am quaintly citing the Constitution. There's nothing in there that says, well, if the president says it, then he can start implementing crazy climate policies as long as he declares an emergency. What is the practical effect of declaring it? Is it just rhetorical? Or would he think that this means he has additional powers now? What does it all mean?
It's quite scary, I think, particularly in light of what happened with COVID, because you see how flexible the idea of emergency powers is in the minds of people today. And ultimately, like, the government has the power that people interpret it as having. And you saw with COVID, there was this idea when you had this new virus emerge and people were scared of it. It wasn't simply, hey, if you have the virus, quarantine, which is kind of the classical way of doing things and innocent until proven guilty and this kind of thing. It was literally, we can indefinitely lock you in your home because we consider you guilty until proven innocent because you might have a virus. Like, that is a really un-American thing to do, indefinitely everywhere. So that's what it thinks it has in terms of emergency powers. It can essentially stop all human activity taking place outside the household, which is obviously almost all productive activity. So I take that seriously when I think about how is he going to interpret emergency. The other thing is he has already said he thinks he's quasi-declared an emergency. And in a sense, he has, because he's usurped this crazy amount of executive power to throttle every aspect of fossil fuel production and use. So he's used executive power to push these various onerous ESG restrictions on companies, to threaten them for having a fossil future, for, you know, trying to invest in hydrocarbons, which is, that's just a more tactical term for fossil fuels. He has assaulted fossil fuel production. Look at what he did to leasing on federal lands. He's assaulted fossil fuel transportation. Look at destroying the Keystone XL pipeline, which was very close to being built, as one of his first administrative acts. So he's already used way more power than he has any right to do under any constitution or under our constitution and under any law. And now he's saying, that's not enough. So give me way more. And he is now using the term emergency that was used to indefinitely lock people in their homes with no recourse. So that scares the hell out of me.
Do you ever speculate on motives here? I mean, you have to. Obviously, there are some environmentalists whose ideology we're all too familiar with. I understand what their motivation is, but I don't think most politicians are really rigidly attached to an ideology like that and that they're just implementing it. Maybe some of them are. But so there has to be some other reason. what would consume them with a desire to carry forward with something that is obviously going to impoverish a lot of people? Is it really that they innocently are trying to implement a policy that they think will avert catastrophes? Or is there something more sinister afoot? Are they stupid? Are they evil? Are they both? I mean, obviously, you've given this some thought.
Well, let's just talk about, you said we're all familiar with motives of certain of the environmentalists, or I often better call them, I think, impact haters, which is just they think of human impact as evil.
Yeah.
Ultimately, humanity is evil. If you think its impact is evil, that means you think it's evil because all species impact things. Like if you thought bear impact was evil, that means you hate bears, right? And you want to kill bears. So there's a whole thing about human impact is evil. It's wrong for us to change anything. And if we do, nature is going to punish us. This idea human impact is evil, I think, is everywhere to varying degrees. So there are the more purists, but you just look, conventional people really have this idea of, oh, if we're having any impact on climate, that is immoral and we should stop that at all costs. That's what net zero means. It means stop impacting the climate by 2050 as our number one goal in civilization. And that is literally the number one goal in civilization. If you look at what governments agree to, what corporations agree to, et cetera. Now, do they all fully realize the anti-human implications of it? No, not at all. So then it gets to what are the other kinds of motives? And I think you mentioned, so one that I think will be familiar to your audience is people who have power lust and in general statists like any idea whereby the vast majority of the population acting freely is a threat that the government has a right to intervene in. This was part of the sort of sick enthusiasm for COVID that certain statists had, where it's, oh, wait, everyone breathing is potentially a criminal, and therefore I get to tell them what to do. And I was pretty open. Hey, we could do this with climate too. And you see the idea of CO2 as this toxic gas that's ruining everything. That means every human being is evil and needs to be controlled to protect everyone. So there's a statist just power lust excitement about something in this category of catastrophe. And then you ask, do people believe in the catastrophe? Well, I think yes and no. They don't believe in it in that they're really scared of it. Like Joe Biden doesn't wake up every morning and he's terrified of climate, whereas Joe Biden's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather probably was, right? Because he lived in a pre-climate mastery era. But they certainly believe this could be like a very consequential negative change. And crucially, they see no cost to addressing that change because they see no benefit to fossil fuel use going forward. And you mentioned Vivek before. I thought one thing that was really eye-opening to me, and I don't think I get my eyes open that often in terms of the culture, but Vivek during the first debate had this thing he said, which is absolutely true, which is that climate policies kill far more people than climate change. And if you look at the numbers, climate disaster deaths have gone down 98% over the last 100 years, and a lot of that is fossil fuel use. So in a sense, climate change has killed negative 40 million people, right? If you include fossil fuels with that. But what was notable is the critics said, no. We've documented there are 2 million extreme weather deaths over the last 50 years. And you think about that, wait a second, that's 40,000 a year. That's really low. In the 30s, you would have millions a year sometimes. So they don't even get that. But what was so interesting in their articles, they said, well, look, they blamed fossil fuels for every climate-related death somehow. Like there were none before. They don't even realize that they've decreased. But then what was so notable is they said climate policies have not been responsible for one death. And I just want you to think about this for a second. Climate policies refers to the wholesale restriction of fossil fuel investment, production, refining, and transportation around the world.
Yeah.
And the use of fossil fuels is directly correlated with massive increases in life expectancy, including the huge rise of China and India in the last 40 or 50 years. So to say that any policy that's restricting economic activity has no deaths associated with it is insane, let alone restricting the literal fuel of civilization that powers every machine that allows us to live the way that they do. So what it struck me is these are total fossil fuel benefit deniers. They see no cost at all in doing this stuff, despite what's in front of us just doing a little of their agenda, causing a global energy crisis. So when you think that a policy has no cost that's designed to address some catastrophe, you don't really care about the magnitude of the catastrophe because you think it's free. And I think that's a big part of it. People have thought that it's free to deal with this alleged catastrophe. And so they don't feel so bad about exaggerating it, including a lot of the scientists don't, because they're like, yeah, it's the right thing to do. And who cares if we restrict fossil fuels? And I'm like, no, fossil fuels make the planet livable and are needed by billions of people. That cost, if you did net zero, is a Holocaust. And I mean that literally, like in terms of the death. Like if you restrict fossil fuel use and eliminate it by 2050, that is far beyond anything human beings have ever done in terms of negative. So if you view that as costless, you are effectively insane and a threat to civilization.
Yeah. Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Monetary Metals. This is a company I've been using for a year or two, and it's fantastic. Now, if you're like me, you probably own some gold. But also, if you're like me, wherever you have that gold stored, it's probably just sitting there, not really doing much for you. If anything, it might be racking up storage fees so that over time you wind up with less rather than more. But what if you could put that gold to work for you? I mean, what if you could get it to do something for you? And that's exactly what Monetary Metals is all about. You can grow your gold year after year with Monetary Metals, which offers interest on gold paid in more ounces of physical gold. You can earn 2 to 5% on gold and silver in their leasing program, which supports qualified gold-using businesses. And if you're an accredited investor, you can earn higher returns, think double digits, in their gold bond offerings. All the interest is paid in physical ounces of gold, so your total ounces grow and compound year after year. So over a 10-year period, for example, 2.5% annual, 100 ounces becomes 128. At 3%, 100 ounces becomes 134. At 4%, 100 ounces becomes 148. You get the idea. They've been at this for 7 years. Jeff Deist, formerly of the Mises Institute, recently joined forces with them. Their vice president of relationships, Addison Quayle, has been at my house. He's been a friend of the Tom Woods Show. I've seen him at conferences all over the place. These are our people, and they're doing something really, really creative and important. So start saving and earning in gold. Go to monetary-metals.com/woods to learn more about how to get started with your account. Don't forget the hyphen. That's monetary-metals.com/woods. Well, there are similarities, eerie similarities between COVID and climate change. So there's one evil similarity, which is you can imagine them, and you don't have to imagine them, contemplating lockdowns along the lines of the COVID ones, but this time because of the climate. But there's one similarity that might have had the effect of opening people's eyes a little bit. And the similarity here is both COVID and climate change involved an expert class dealing with an alleged problem that they vastly exaggerated human authority over. And they vastly exaggerate how much they can control it. And they congratulate themselves for anything that goes right. And they blame stupid, backward people for not listening to them every time something goes wrong. And it looks like the same kind of thing. So I wonder if after the COVID ordeal, some people who became red-pilled or more skeptical of official pronouncements come out of this saying, you know, the next time the elites are obsessed with something and it's going to be catastrophic if I don't turn my fate and my destiny over to their hands, maybe the next time I'll be a little bit more alert to this. And the climate thing fits the bill perfectly.
I think there are similarities. We'd have to go, and there's a lot of details to COVID. So let me say what I think the similarities are. I think the main similarity that people should get is it is beyond suspicious when people say, listen to the scientists in terms of dictating a particular policy. That is always wrong. And yeah. I think this is very important. So you saw with COVID, there was a certain class of epidemiologists and virologists who had certain views on policy, and in particular, this idea of zero COVID, which means that we should, our number one goal and standard by which we're evaluating policy should be eliminate this one virus at all costs. And this was viewed as, oh, these are scientists, so this is scientific. Right. But that's a value issue, right? That's a value issue to decide that I am eliminating this one virus at all costs. And it is not even a defensible value position that anyone can hold. I mean, how could you possibly justify that? Like, what's your, like, if you're concerned about avoiding death, even if that's just like, you can't say only one virus, you have to look at it in the context of other things. So it was just a perfect example of how, now the scientific authority comes from, if you are a specialist in a field and you accurately convey the best knowledge, including probabilities and uncertainties, if you do that, that is very valuable in policymaking. And I think some people were doing that and some weren't. But anytime you hear, hey, these scientists say do X, just like listen to the scientists, they say go net zero by 2050. You hear this all the time? That is fraud. They cannot possibly know. How could the climate scientists know anything about energy economics. They don't even know. People point out, I'm not a climate scientist. I know far more about the relevant climate information than most climate scientists because I know about climate livability. And the main thing that matters with climate is not exactly what's happening in the atmosphere. It's how livable it is. But that's primarily a function of how good humans are at mastering. And that relates to energy and economics and things I know about that most climate scientists know nothing. But it's so dangerous. And so I hope people take that lesson. I hope they don't take the lesson, well, experts are wrong and we should never listen to them. And I do see some of that. That's dangerous because you do need expertise, but you need it. One idea I think that's important is you need people who explain, like explain, don't dictate. So they explain their reasons for things. They don't just appeal to their authority. If you have authority, utilize that authority to explain what you know, what you don't know, how you know it. But as soon as you say, here's what policy needs to be, I know that you don't know what you're talking about in the realm of policy.
Well, I rely on experts all the time, implicitly. Every time I get in my car, I have absolutely no idea how that thing goes. I don't know anything about it, but I'm confident that it'll go fine. I just the other day became Diamond Medallion on Delta. So I fly a lot. Don't know anything about flight, but I know other people do and I trust them. And I assume that there's a process by which we refine the, and not to mention, I have a record that I can look at of a whole lot of successful flights and very, very few flights that are not completed for one reason or another. So I have good reason to feel that way. But when I look at the way the political classes have manipulated science or exploited science or called on the good name of science to defend where they stand on climate or COVID, I think those have both been examples of where they have not even remotely tried to have a rational discussion with people. They try to shut people down, censor them, demean them, imply that they don't understand science, they're all stupid, and all the sophisticated people think the way they do. When they start acting like that, then I think we should assume something is up. And it is. There is something up in this case. But the thing is, people will say to you, though, Alex Epstein, I'm sure they have multiple times, there are lots of scientists who, by the way, let me say in parentheses, I like your response about scientists making value judgments and that that's not science per se. That was happening all through COVID. We were acting like if scientists said the only thing that matters right now is COVID, well, that's the science. Well, that's their value judgment. I think there are a lot of things that matter. I don't go to a scientist to tell me what I'm supposed to value. I go to my own values. I go to my philosophy to tell me what I value. But at the same time, let's get the value judgments out and let's stick to the facts. There will be people who say that there are scientists who are more confident than you are that fossil fuel use will lead to, if not catastrophic outcomes, highly undesirable outcomes. And that that's the level on which you should engage with the scientists, where they're not advocating a Green New Deal or whatever, but they're just saying, this looks like the trend. And they could even say, Alex Epstein says he favors human flourishing. Well, so do we. We just happen to think that there's a catastrophe potentially coming that would inhibit human flourishing.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly looked into that. I didn't investigate this, but you have to look at what is their methodology? But you said leaving values out of it, but unfortunately you can't do that when it comes to concepts like catastrophe, because catastrophe is a value concept, right? It's saying that according to some standard of value, something went really, really wrong. And one thing that's revealing about how catastrophists think of catastrophe, the climate catastrophe movement, is they consider today's climate a catastrophe, even though it is well documented and refuted by no one that we are safer from climate disaster than ever. So if we have the most livable climate in history and you call it a catastrophe, what's your standard? And it's not human flourishing, even if you say it is. It isn't. Their standard is eliminating human impact. The belief that an unimpacted Earth and an unimpacted climate is the ideal, and we should get as close to that as possible. Why is everyone's climate goal? It's their overall goal, which makes no sense, but it's their climate goal. Net zero by 2050, which means no climate impact. Why isn't it improve climate livability by 2050, which depends on energy? So their definition of catastrophe is wrong. And then if you look at their methodology, they are what I call climate mastery deniers. So they're only looking at changes in the atmosphere and then speculating on how they would impact human life, but they're not accounting for our ability to master climate. But as we've seen over the last 100 years, we made ourselves far safer from climate using mastery. Mastery is the dominant variable. Whatever has happened in climate, we've been impacting climate for 100 years. whatever has happened there has been far outweighed in significance by the increasing mastery ability. So you can't be a climate mastery denier, and yet the whole establishment is. If you look at, say, the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change out of the UN, they have thousands of pages of reports, and they don't mention anything about fossil-fueled climate mastery, and they don't mention the decline in climate disaster deaths. I mean, imagine a polio report that didn't mention declining polio deaths, didn't mention polio vaccine, didn't mention sanitation. Like, this would be insane. But our whole climate thing is not focused on climate livability, and it evades climate mastery. It's focused on climate non-impact. That's its goal. Its God is an unimpacted climate. That's somehow perfect. That is not perfect. We didn't inherit a perfect climate. The best possible climate is one that we have a lot of mastery over, in my view.
Let's suppose there were some way that global temperatures could be controlled, let's say just with the flip of a switch, that there were no trade-offs whatsoever. And we could just say, we would rather not have the warming that we've been having. How would we make that decision? Because there are obviously positives and negatives of rising temperatures. Is there one set of temperatures that's optimal, and how would we choose that?
It's really hard to know. It's a good kind of question because it strips the issue of the bias that if we impact things, it must be bad. You think logically, well, we have to look when we impact things. Is it good or is it bad? And I think it's hard to say globally. I mean, in general, you could say warming is probably going to be more beneficial than not. With CO2, it comes with greening. On the other hand, there's some uncertainty about exactly how it plays out. So it's hard to say. What you would really want is the ability to control your CO2 for free, right? So then you could look at evidence and learn, and you might decide, hey, we want to get to 1,000 parts per million way more quickly than we otherwise would. Or you might say, hey, we want to do it at this point. I think in the future, what's going to happen is local climate changes are always more significant than global. I think in the future, people are going to think more about how do we change our local climate. You even see people trying to do this with having more rainfall in deserts and changing land use to make places more fertile. And this will be the future of climate mastery. You think in 300 years, human beings aren't going to be controlling climate? Like, we are. We are going to be. And that's a good thing. I mean, you have to think about how to do it. But like right now, if we could neutralize hurricanes, most parts of the world would choose to be like where I live in Southern California, if they could. Many would. And unfortunately, that allows California to be an absolutely horrific government because people stay here and pay huge taxes for terrible services because it's so nice. I think a lot of people in the Midwest will probably choose in the future to have a more California-like climate.
Obviously, the developing world would be hit the hardest because they desperately need what they need more than almost anything else is inexpensive energy. And if they don't have the ability to get that, then it's very hard to see what their path to development is. I suppose unless they invest in nuclear, but...
Yeah, that's not going to do it in the near future.
In the near future, right. So I don't have any illusions about the good intentions of politicians, but you would think there would have to be somebody in the developing world who's governing a country who can see the writing on the wall. I can see that these trends toward demonizing fossil fuels are going to lead to, we have all these people telling us there are no deaths caused by climate policy. There'll be deaths, and there'll be deaths in his country. And yet, why is there not some organized, there used to be a Pan-African movement. Why isn't there a pan-developing league of countries that demand the freedom to develop? Why don't they stand up for themselves?
It's a good idea, and I've been advocating it for a while, and I'm happy that there's been some progress in it. And I have quite a following in Africa in particular. I'm in fact in about a month, October 17th in particular, so a little over a month, I'm going to be keynoting at Africa Energy Week in Cape Town. And this is one of the themes I'm going to talk about is how to galvanize Africans in particular, but the developing world more broadly, to fight for their freedom to produce and use fossil fuels. Going to the individual countries and talking to leaders and talking to citizens, there's a lot of enthusiasm. Unfortunately, that enthusiasm gets quelled by the United States and other nations who are basically saying, hey, don't do what we did, not just what we did, don't do what we're doing, and somehow figure out how to become prosperous using green energy somehow, even though we ourselves are just using green energy and making ourselves poorer, but you guys figure out how to become rich. Don't do what China did. Don't do what India did. Don't do what Singapore did. Don't do what South Korea did. Don't do what Japan did. Do this new thing that doesn't work for anybody. And that's what we think of your lives. That's what we want to foist on you. And what you see is China is trying to fill in the vacuum or to counter it. And they're saying to people, hey, like, we'll help you with these different things. Now, China is not a good actor in many different ways, but you can see why they're drawn to China. I think that's tragic. That's something I'm working on with U.S. politicians, and I'm trying to work on with Africans as well, including any African politicians who are remotely pro-development or pro-freedom, because it's a huge opportunity and you're starting to see it. I want this pretty cool guy in Africa that I befriended maybe a year or two ago and helped with some stuff. A guy, you can find him on Twitter, Jusper Machogu, Jusper Machogu. He's been really taking up this idea. He like created an internship where kind of elites from the West can come visit him and see what it's like to have a manual labor farm. And he's actually started building like infrastructure in his community. People have been donating. He's bringing different kinds of like natural gas, liquid petroleum gas for people to have clean cook stoves and bringing in pumps for clean water. And he's starting to get attention. And maybe I'll get some more after this. There's a guy who runs Africa Energy Chamber named NJ Ayuk, NJ, the letters, and then space AYUK. He's doing a lot of cool stuff. He's the one who really insisted on bringing me out to Cape Town. So I think these guys need more attention, and it's going to happen. But it's, you're right, it's an obvious thing. And one thing is the quote unquote elites in the West will have nothing to say about this. Like, what, they have nothing to say. If people who need energy and our poor Africans stand up for their rights, these guys are just going to shut up.
And I mean, really, how are people in Bangladesh going to afford an electric car? You know, they know that that's a no-go for these people. Literal no-go. And yet,
I mean, Americans can barely afford it.
Barely afford it.
And our grid can't afford it is the obvious elephant in the room that nobody's talking about. It's just we have a declining supply, decline in the availability of reliable electricity. And we're talking about an incredibly rapid increase in demand for reliable electricity. Has anyone ever studied economics before?
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Hey, everybody, let me tell you about the upcoming Expat Money Summit hosted by Expat Money Show host Mikkel Thorup and two-time Tom Woods Show guest. Mikkel has lived everywhere, visited everywhere. He knows everything there is to know about international relocation and a whole bunch of issues short of international relocation, like second passports or banking offshore or whatever it is you're interested in regarding the expat lifestyle. And this whole event, which, by the way, features me as a speaker, is free. It's taking place October 2nd through the 6th online. You can check it out at expatmoneysummit.com. It is the largest offshore event in the world. And confirmed speakers include Ron Paul, Doug Casey, Mark Faber, Jim Rogers, me. Also, international lawyers, offshore precious metals dealers, foreign real estate experts, and much, much more. So we're going to be talking about finding a safe place to live in the world, legally eliminating your tax bill so you're not funding war, international wealth protection, second passports, offshore banking, and much more. So check it out by getting your free ticket at expatmoneysummit.com. That's expatmoneysummit.com. Well, look, I want to take the last few moments. Now, we could do a whole episode on this, and maybe someday we will, but maybe we can tantalize people with it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I think you know where I'm going with this because you hinted at this.
I suggested it.
Yeah, you suggested it. So obviously you are part of the objectivist movement. I don't know. There are different groups and none of that matters to me. But you would identify yourself as an objectivist, which means that you believe in the philosophy of Ayn Rand. Now, I very much like Ayn Rand. In fact, my copy of, you can see that there's a gap in these books here.
Uh-huh.
That's because Atlas Shrugged is not there anymore because one of my kids is reading it. So,
oh, that's great.
Yeah. So they get some use in here. And I'll say also in parentheses, if you have not read some of the nonfiction essays by Rand, you are missing out because when she demolishes somebody, it is unlike any takedown you've seen. You do not want to be on the wrong side of her. So I'm quite fond of her. Like with anybody, there are aspects of her philosophy that I'm not completely convinced by. But the fact that it is clearly an objectivist perspective on this climate issue to say that we should be looking at this from the standpoint of human flourishing, I think that's a net positive. I think people should think that way. I think that's a net benefit for mankind, for people to think that way. So what's your background that you came to be so influenced by Ayn Rand that it comes out in your scientific writing?
You mentioned her demolishing things. It wasn't quite that, but it wasn't too far from that really got me started on her. Because I got introduced to her in an unusual way. I was at Duke University. I was trying to avoid studying for a physics exam as a freshman. And there was a book in the library called Letters of Ayn Rand, which these are just letters that she's writing.
Oh, it's big, yeah.
Yeah, it's a giant book. And I was like, I would do anything. And I'd met some smart people who called themselves objectivists. And I was thinking about my own ideas at the time. But I hadn't read Atlas Shrugged or anything like that at that point. But I read and I saw she had these letters to Barry Goldwater in particular. And she was challenging him on this book, The Conscience of a Conservative, which she had been a supporter of Goldwater, but she had endorsed him for president, which is very unusual for her, that, you know, she liked him more than she liked almost any Republican. But she was just writing it about the idea of conservative. And she made this point that just seemed so obvious, but I had never heard anyone make it before. She said, you know, he was referring to like America as a conservative nation, but she pointed out, well, the founding fathers were not conservatives. They were revolutionaries. And she was challenging this idea of conservative, like you shouldn't value something because it's old. You shouldn't value it because it's new either. But she pointed out in this and other work that it's a ridiculous thing that we have the two poles are you value things because they're old and you value things because they're new. Like that's just the wrong way of thinking. And then challenging the idea of founding fathers were conservatives. And it really introduced me to she's very precise about terminology and about thinking methodology. I read Atlas Shrugged pretty quickly and just, I loved it. But the thing that really struck me about her that I think my experience was distinctive was I thought she really knows how to think about things in a unique way. And I want to learn that way of thinking myself. And I felt like anyone who could learn the way in which she's thinking will be very powerful in their field. Often when, and this is in contrast to others, I think, where often when you have a minority philosophy, and objectivism is certainly a minority philosophy today and has been throughout its history, there's a view of kind of, oh, well, it's a disadvantage. Nobody's going to like you because you have these crazy views and stuff. And I viewed it as, well, no, it's going to allow me to think more clearly. So whatever I do, at the time, I wanted to be primarily an entrepreneur. Now I'm a kind of an intellectual entrepreneur. This is going to help me a lot. And so if you look at, I mean, there's so many things to say about my work, but if you look at just Fossil Future and how precise and different it is about terminology, just I do not use any of the conventional terms very deliberately. So you can talk about like sustainability is like a Marxist anti-human term that everyone just adopts. But I question it because I have an idea of how to properly form concepts and how to ferret out bad concepts. Even the idea of using climate change, I don't use. I talk about, you know, man-made climate impact because climate change is what she would call a package deal of a lot of things that don't go together. And so, you know, there's so much to say, but I would say, of course, read her fiction, but as you said, read her nonfiction. And one essay that I think your audience should really check out is the first essay in the book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. What is capitalism? Because there she's really challenging. She's challenging a lot of the assumptions and values that are implicit in much of modern economics, but that people don't question. And I think that'll be really interesting to people to just read that. And don't read it from the perspective of, you know, you have to agree with all of it or not of it. Like,
yeah.
Just think of it as, here's an interesting thing. Like, I happen to agree with a huge amount of what she said. Not all of it, but a huge amount of what she said. But it's not like a binary thing. Like, you shouldn't approach it that way. Like, oh, am I going to adopt this new religion or not? Like, just think of it as, do you think this makes sense? And I think if you read that, you're like, wow, this is a really interesting mind. And many people on the left and right have been way too dismissive of this mind.
Yeah, that I definitely agree. And the thing is, anytime somebody finds, you probably don't call yourself a libertarian, but I do, the mainstream media, the only thing they say, oh, you must like Ayn Rand. Like they only know like two libertarians, Milton Friedman and Ayn Rand. Like they don't know anybody else. But on the other hand, it shows that she made an impact, that she's one of the names they come up with. Well, one of the reasons, by the way, that that book is missing from my shelf is that I have read now to, I have five daughters and the first two of them, I read to them the 20th Century Motor Company. Where this is a company that tries to implement from each according to his ability to each according to his need. And the way that this is described, how this turns out, you're immediately convinced that this is exactly how it would turn out. And I feel like that alone inoculates you against these ideas. So I had the book downstairs because I was going to read it. I think it's time for the third daughter to hear this. Well, my 20-year-old daughter happened to be home and she saw it and said, you know, I never read this book. So now it's gone, but I'll find that portion of it somewhere because everybody in this household gets that read to them. Because I've not seen anybody convey it. Yeah, I could write you an article about what the problems are, Mm-hmm. But this puts you in, I mean, you can imagine this world she's describing where you're working for this company where they're implementing what you're told is a really noble idea. But then you see the way your face is ground in it by this idea, how demonic it is. I don't know what else to say about it. So that's why I very much enjoy reading her.
Yeah, I just thought people should know about her, particularly your audience. And if they like the way that I think that particularly if they, because what I don't like the most is when people don't get exposed to good things because they hear them dismissed by people they respect. And I feel like the world would be a much better place as if in college, the professors, instead of saying, hey, Ayn Rand, she's an idiot, it's a cult, whatever they like to say, said, hey, this is an interesting thinker that you should check out. Like, I think if you go into it with that, some of you at least will have the reaction I did. Wow, this is something that's really can make you a much more powerful thinker. And I do think some of the best thinkers that I know in the world are objectivists. There are not as many great ones as I would like, but maybe I'll inspire some others today.
Well, I mean, look, as a matter of fact, I have it right here. I mean, this book was written by an objectivist. You probably know him, but have you seen this book by George Reisman?
Oh, yeah, I've read quite a bit of that book.
Yeah, I mean, now I want you to see, I mean, only an objectivist would have written a book on this scale. And then you open it up and it looks like this.
I know.
So he told me that the index alone took him 3 months to do. He should have just farmed that out. But it's like, in a way, I look at this and I feel like this is like the Atlas Shrugged of economics, this thing, this massive tome. And yeah, I remember when I got it and, you know, it's sort of, it's eclectic in its influences. So it's Austrian, but it's also classical economics with some modifications. And I got this probably 20 years ago or so. And I remember like my family would hear me in the morning turning pages and it was me reading this. And so I appreciated, I mean, his philosophy is all over this thing. He does not try to present economics as a value-free discipline, as most of the people I follow do. His value system is all through this, particularly in his chapter on environmentalism.
Which is great. I was going to mention that.
Dripping with contempt, right?
Is particularly, and he's one of the thinkers who influenced me on these issues because he really took good philosophy and good economics. I mean, he has, you know, I even quote him sometimes because he has this amazing line to the effect of, you shouldn't trust a quote-unquote environmentalist scientist as someone who's against human impact. That he said, that's like taking medical advice from a doctor who's on the side of the germs.
Yes.
If they're not on team human, you shouldn't take policy advice.
Yeah.
From, he's got tons of valuable stuff. So yeah, so that's an example of somebody who's a really good thinker, did a lot of good work, and, you know, was, you know, his two idols were Ayn Rand and von Mises.
Yeah.
And he got to spend a lot of time, probably more than anyone, spent time with both. I don't know anyone who had that dual exposure.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I know people who knew them both, but somebody who was really in, I mean, he was at Mises Seminar. He translated one of his books into English from German, so obviously knew him quite intimately. And I think he may actually have been one of the handful of people who got his PhD under Mises. Very, very few people did in the
U.S.
I
think that's right.
But anyway, well, listen, I'm going to recommend, I'll have in the description and at tomwoods.com/2392, a link, of course, to Fossil Future. But since I know you folks probably have read that, and if you haven't, I'm shaming you into doing it, then go over and support what Alex is doing by subscribing to his Substack. I mean, there's free material, but you can also support what Alex is doing because he's fighting the fight.
Don't worry about supporting it. Just get the free stuff. I have other ways of making money. I'm not making too much of a living. I will say, though, in a few weeks, if you become a paid subscriber, you all have access. Tom, you get this for free. But AlexGPT. So there's a chatbot that answers every question as me, and it's shockingly good. I've invested a lot of money and time into it, and I have an amazing team. You'll be shocked by how good this thing is at answering anything. So that's coming in a week or two.
Ah, wow. So if it can also do your voice, then I don't even have to bother you anymore to come on the show, right?
Yeah, we're working on that. It's probably a year or two away, but I'll send you a link after this, but you can't share it. It'll be a private link.
I won't, but what a world.
I think you'll have fun playing with it. And of course, we welcome feedback.
Well, there's a sister site of ChatGPT, Character AI, that my daughters introduced me to. And they found there's a Tom Woods bot on it. And they're having fun playing with it. And then they'll send me his answers and say, is this really what you would have said? And I'd say, this guy's full of it. So anyway.
Yeah, mine is pretty good.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. I can't wait to see. But all the same, go check out Alex's Substack. As I say, the link will be on the show notes page and in the description of this video. Thanks so much, Alex. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.